It's Jimmy Buff. It's Peter Buffett. It's the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club. Surviving the Future is a book edited from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic, the editor Sean Chamberlain. The book subtitled Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. We have been granted permission by Sean Chamberlain and by the publisher Chelsea Green to air the audiobook in chapter form week after week until we're done.
Which is pretty great. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Chelsea Green. And thank you, Jimmy Buff, for coming up with the idea.
And thank you, Peter Buffett, for being here every Tuesday afternoon to share your thoughts on what we hear each week. Before we get to Chapter 10, how did you... I'm not sure how you got turned onto the book or if I know that story.
I can only hope I remember it. I think I read some... You know, sometimes when they promote a book, they do little... you know, there's an article or a blog post or something that comes out, and I'm sure it was from Sean, and I read it and found contact information for Sean, and just we connected, we got together over Skype or Zoom or something, and said, you know, had this mutual admiration society. Oh, actually, it was one way because he had no idea really what I was, who I was, or what I was doing, but yeah. I think that's it. I got the book, loved it, and then asked if we could, through the foundation, make it available at various gatherings of like-minded people, that sort of thing, just really push it out there. And of course, the publisher loved that, which is, you know, makes total sense. And as well as Sean, I mean, who doesn't like a fan that wants to spread your work? I mean, whether it's music, books, whatever. And so we just, you know, again, it was so exciting and refreshing to find this book and this person. So to continue the relationship and find other ways we can get the book out there is fantastic.
Yeah, and it's been extraordinary doing it this way each Tuesday because I get to hear it again. I get to read along with it, mm-hmm. and I get to get the sense of its importance to what we do here at Radio Kingston and how it can affect the area that we're in becomes clearer and clearer each week.
And that's what's so fun about it. This is like a really tight feedback loop where I read the book. It inspired me so much. So much of the work in Kingston came from... the foundational ideas in the book, and then to be able to play it on the air now that there's a station, and it's fantastic. It's great.
Well, we are halfway.
Oh my gosh.
This is the halfway point. It's chapter 10.
Chapter 10. Religion. Religion has a curious relationship with truth. To tease it out, we will need to identify five forms of truth. Material truth is direct, plain, literal description of reality. There is no interest here in exploring deeper implications, insights, and echo meanings. This is the truth which tells you about the route taken by the hot water pipe from the boiler to the bathroom. How to make flatbread. How to photograph otters. What Darwinism is. Why a herd of cows' milk yield is higher if the cows are named as well as numbered. What a well-tempered scale is. What a Higgs boson probably is, why pregnant women don't topple over, whether you went to the pub last night. Accuracy is not essential. It does not have to be true to belong in the domain of material truth, but it does have to be the speaker's intention that the other person should understand it to be true. It can use metaphor that helps to get an unfamiliar idea across, but the intention is to provide a truthful and uncluttered description. Here, facts matter. For religion, there is material truth in its historical account and in at least some of religion's practical and ethical teaching. Narrative truth, or poetic truth, we have met before, at the carnival. It is the truth present not just in storytelling, but in myth, art, and the whole of our culture. This is the truth of Pride and Prejudice. It is not materially true in that it is fiction. On the other hand, it is true to life. It is as accurate an insight into human character as we have. Elizabeth Bennet's story can neither be dismissed as untrue nor accepted as true. It is in the middle ground. It may or may not report the material truth, but the narrative says something that cannot be said in any other way. It has a shadow meaning that extends beyond metaphor and can lead to the discovery of material or implicit truths. as an explorer in search of the Holy Grail, may discover and map real mountains and rivers. Narrative truth makes sense of the roots of our word belief, which comes to our literal-minded age from a story-rich antiquity. It can be traced to the ancient Germanic root, Glaubian, to hold dear. The Latin for to believe is credere, which comes from cordare, to give one's heart. Narrative truth may be a parable with a clear message, or a story for the story's sake, or the meaning may be forever unknown, a question to be reflected on, perhaps the subject of a lifetime's exploration. It is the domain of poetry, music, laughter. If you ask whether it is materially true, you are at the wrong party. And yet, our culture regularly lacks the mature judgment necessary to distinguish between material and narrative truth. A work of art makes the question of whether it is true or not absurd. It is a category error and should not be asked. You might as well ask whether Schubert's string quintet in C major Deutsch number 956 likes broccoli. Although religion inhabits all five forms of truth, narrative truth is at its core, most obviously in its allegory, parable, and myth. Implicit truth is the product of reflection and is particular to the person reflecting. Different people may reach sharply different insights, which may, however, all be true, despite contrasts in emphasis and meaning. They are different in that they are features in the landscape of the observer's different cognitive homelands. The differences may be consistent with each other, or they may mature into deep contradictions. This is my territory. The ideal place for our honeymoon would be Scunthorpe. We've won! All these are true or untrue, depending on who is speaking, but all are in the category of implicit truth. Religion's implicit truth is the insight derived from deliberation. It is the guidance, comfort, inspiration, and prudence derived by a person's own participation in his or her religion. Performative truth is the truth that is created by statements that do something. I challenge, I thee wed, I bet, I curse, thank you. The speaking makes the truth. A promise is brought into existence by being spoken. Loyal cantons of contemned love make love come alive. Performative truths can also be created by symbolic events or even thoughts. Contracts are an example. They may be recorded, but the contract itself has no material expression. You cannot see it or say where it is, and if minds change profoundly enough, it may simply cease to exist. The performative truth of religion lies in its ritual, as in the performance of the Christian Eucharist and other practices of religion which affirm and bring into existence a reality of identity and belief as real as, and in many ways the same as, a contract. And self-denying truth. This is paradox which contradicts itself. It is materially true until it is spoken. The speaking of a self-denying truth kills it. Examples: I refuse to admit my addiction. The religious belief which unites us so securely is in fact a useful falsehood. The reason we have such a loving relationship is that you remind me of my mother. It is a matter of acknowledging the limits of what we can say without destroying the truth in the process. You can kill an insight by analyzing it, love by telling it. Never seek to tell thy love, love that never told can be. For the gentle wind does move, silently, invisibly. I told my love, I told her all my heart, trembling, cold in ghastly fears. Ah, she doth depart. Soon as she was gone from me, a traveller came by. Silently, invisibly, oh, was no deny. William Blake, never seek to tell thy love, 1793. Self-denying truth is the opposite of performative truth. It is a statement which makes itself untrue. By unpacking a useful mystery, you are making it no longer a mystery, and maybe no longer useful. Religion involves a self-denying truth, in that the commanding authority of a myth is impaired or even destroyed when it is described as a myth. The author of this book, as a critic, affirms the truth of this description of religion, but as an observant, he denies it, and instead enters into the performative truth which gives religion real presence. All five forms of truth, then, are exuberantly present in religion, which, if confined in the narrow space inhabited by material truth, decays into fundamentalism. There are paradoxes and shadow meanings in all of these, especially in narrative truth and self-denying truth, yet all five are needed for the common purpose of making a future, which requires both brain and soul. Alfred North Whitehead, with the sureness of touch of a philosopher of science, captures it. Religion is the vision of something which stands beyond, behind, and within the passing flux of immediate things. Something which is real and yet waiting to be realized. Something which is a remote possibility and yet the greatest of present facts. Something that gives meaning to all that passes and yet eludes apprehension. Something whose possession is the final good and yet is beyond all reach. Something which is the ultimate ideal and the hopeless quest. Religions are works of art, narrative truths affirmed by ritual. They variously assert the existence of many gods, one god, a mystical union of three gods in one, or their myth does not have a concept of God at all. The narrative truth and the ritual in which it is affirmed have essential functions for a community, for the individuals within it, and for its social capital. They embrace its culture, giving it identity and meaning. Religion, like all other living things, dies if dissected. The dissector kills what he seeks to understand. It exists because it is performed, declared, and loved. The view that dismisses religion on the grounds that it contains untrue statements is a solecism, a naive failure to understand the significance of religion, the culture which it expresses, and the many natures of truth. If a common practice celebrates the identifying narrative or myth of a community, if it is expressed in one or more of the arts, especially music, if there is at least a degree of repetition and constancy in that expression, and if it requires some or many members of the community to participate, it is, for surviving the future, an expression of religion. At least to some degree. Binary definitions, this is or is not religious, have value only at the extremes, at which the identification of the religious is trivial in any case. What is religion for? Religion provides meeting places in which people can come together, building and sustaining the friendships of social capital. It is the hub through which needs are signalled and answered. That can be done in other ways too, of course, by playing cards or being a regular at the pub or being on a committee. But religion can do it in ways which these other meeting places cannot. It enables a lot of people to participate in a collective activity, doing the same thing at the same time, to the same music. Its ritual is, in itself, of no direct practical value, and this makes it especially potent and effective as a statement by participants that they are there as members of the community. It delivers tradition to us, a present from the past, where core values are represented in forms of exceptional beauty. And it brings shared presence. In religious observance, friends, neighbours, beloveds and families face the same way. The critic will point out that religion can bring strife as well as concord, that there have been many abuses of power, that some expressions of religion misapprehend their own myths by, for instance, naively supposing the creation story to be fact. Religion, like every other human enterprise, comes with no guarantee of being done well. It can be more drawn to guilt than to joy, to the personal than the collective, to righteous narcissism than to communal care. Religion can be intolerant, sanctimonious, and cruel. But it is hard to think of any political or social order to which these regrettable properties do not apply from time to time. The secular world, too, with chilling good intentions, and at whatever cost in lives and capital in all its forms, sometimes tries to build a new and secular Jerusalem. But look again at what religion can do. Religion is the community speaking. It is culture in the service of the community. It is a framework for integrating care into the community's life and culture. It takes charitable giving beyond the level of personal conscience and integrates it into the way the community sees itself and expresses itself. Religion uses allegory, opening up the potent space of questions unsettled, paradoxes unresolved, beauty undescribed. It occupies, with benign myth, the space in the mind which, if vacated, is wide open to take over by ideology. Akin to carnival, it provides powerfully cohesive rituals that give reality to membership of the community and locate it as particular to and steward of the place, that invite emotional daring, and that also alert the community to time, to the natural cycles of day and season, as well as to its existence as inheritor from previous generations and benefactor of future generations. The performance of the ritual itself is a skilled practice, recruiting the deep intellectual power which is available only to the subconscious mind. In all these ways, religion underpins the trust and permanence which make it possible to sustain reciprocity. The network of interconnected talent and service which makes the local economy real. We cannot tell what forms the religion of future communities will take. Small communities, with cultures shaped by a closeness to nature, which is held in respect and awe, could be close to pagan spiritualism, like the Lelira of the Inuit and the shamanic religions whose rituals sustain the practices, which in turn sustain their local ecologies. On the other hand, cultures which are settled, more domestic than wild, and with a religion to match, may find themselves in the Christian tradition. If they do, they will inherit a proven, full-mouthed, full-blooded liturgy of great depth and brilliance, the existence of which, if they have formerly experienced only the winsome banalities from the time of the late market economy, they might not suspect. And they will also inherit the architectural expression of that liturgy, the churches, spectacular assertions that community is a mere prelude to the great fugue of overlapping mysteries, parables, affections and accomplishments that give us Gaia. Surviving the future brings whatever values and insights it can to the task of holding community together in the absence of a robust market economy. Religion, from the Latin ligare, to bind, and re, intensely, is the binding together of people with stories, music, dance, emotion, death, spirit, all really about the celebratory making of community, and real enough to give your heart to. Unfortunately, the religions of the world will not, in general, be in good shape for these creative responsibilities. There are four reasons for this. The first is that religions have been shattered and depleted by the disintegration of social structure and the loss of social capital which have followed the advance of the market economy. Religion has been separated from its cultural context and become something that people come together to do, like rally driving. A personal journey for you because that's the sort of thing that you like. At the same time, the advance of science and the literal-minded, disenchanted thinking that is widely taken to be the only sort of thinking there is has made it harder to recognise and accept the poetic discourse of religion. Challenged by science, its leaders and ministers quickly surrendered to the idea that scientific, material truth is the only kind of truth there is. Argued on science's own terms, the religions that have been exposed to the debate in any serious way have been routed. Secondly, and for similar reasons, a large part of, at least, the divided and confused Western Christian Church, as it developed in the late 20th century, has gone to great lengths to present the most plain speaking of interpretations, abandoning the unchanging text needed if people are to have any chance of holding it in the memory. It has scrapped its liturgies and strained instead at spontaneity and at presenting the simple message of personal salvation in literal terms to be accepted as material truth or rejected as false. When it is presented in those terms, many reasonable people have no choice but to refuse to accept a proposition which they reject as simply nonsense. In this way, the Church has thrown out the whole set of implicit functions, narrative and allegorical truths, which are integral to the artistic and cultural meaning of the community, and which are the essence of religion. Christian religion in the market economy has found itself drawn into the idolatry of reducing complex meaning and the reflective imitation of Christ to an iconic imitation of marketing, falling for a technique which it can only do with breathless and piteous amateurism, in place of what it used to do with assured and numinous skill. Thirdly, although at present there is a yearning for an expression of other non-materialistic, non-scientific spiritual values, the established churches almost completely fail to benefit from this. They are not on that wavelength, and for much of the spiritual movement in the world of strongly developed green awareness, the affirmation of a Christian faith stands at the opposite extreme from what they need. It seems cold and absurd, full of confident reassurance about an afterlife, which is not only grossly incredible, but an offence to people whose concern is focused on how much longer there is going to be a planet for this life. Established religion, especially the Christian Church, seems to be the embodiment of urban and human-centred alienation from nature, while green values look for ways to establish some real contact with and come to the defence of the rural. The childishness of happy camper services is disempowering. In contrast, the green movement's central purpose is empowerment, to develop its intelligence and resources to empower its members to act, having observed for themselves the extent of the ecological betrayal that has taken place at the command of centralized urban civilization and its centralized religion since the invention of the plough. And the fourth handicap which religions have to bear, as they find themselves with their new society-building and life-saving responsibilities, is the mixing up of religions which has taken place over the same period. There is no doubt that they have something to learn from each other, gaining insights through their faiths which may not be accessible in any other way. Every religion has something to teach. They are each best in some way. The lean economy which will inherit pluralism will have to derive advantages from them. Nonetheless, pluralism is a self-denying truth. It contradicts itself with multiple claims to authority. If it is spoken too loud, the contradiction is fatal. It has introduced a sense of branding into the matter, which in itself trivializes religious encounter. It effectively forces people to make an instrumental choice with the conscious mind between the seductive appeals of competing retailers in the salvation market, rather than undergoing a bit-by-bit discovery of meaning and affection at the level of the subconscious, starting in childhood, when the foundations for this facility are laid. Pluralism also means that society itself dare not favour one story over another, so collective expression of any one religion becomes an offence to the rest. Many turns into none. Society is thus largely excluded from the benign, shared vocabulary of ceremony, celebration, solidarity, spirit, and belief provided by religion. The culture, scrubbed clean of allegory, is filled with secular kitsch. But the act of transcending this pluralism is something in which art can help. When different traditions develop their artistic differences to the fullest extent, they may find common ground on which there is a chance that they can meet You cannot argue with a song. None of this is rational from the point of view of the market economy, whose instinct for worship is directed to its technology. But the idea that a society can be held together without either an energy-rich market or a culture-rich religion, that is seriously irrational. A coherent social order in the future will need a religion. A religion will need a rich cultural inheritance. It will give culture a real job to do, something to participate in, not simply to be watched, something to give your heart to give you the moral strength you need to keep going, because there is no big something in the sky who is going to do it for you.
That's chapter 10 from Surviving the Future, titled Religion. And in that context, it didn't seem so bad.
It actually, I mean, thank you, David. Thank you, Sean, for that chapter, because it doesn't seem so bad when you back it up and remember what it was, what it was for, the processes involved. I don't know. I wish whatever is necessary, because I completely agree, and it's not going to be something in the sky, it's going to be something right here on the ground. I wish there was another name, because religion now is this, you know, it carries all this baggage from, you know, hundreds of years, really. I mean, anybody that's followed what religion has done, you know, what's been done in the name of God in so many ways, right up to today, but certainly for the past 1,000 or so years, it's, you know, it's a little overwhelming to think it's an effective tool for love and connection.
Yeah. I liked in the chapter when Sean Chamberlain, reading David Fleming's words, says that religion is akin, as in related to carnival.
Yeah.
Because right. The aspects of community involve the shared belief system or shared traditions, shared shared rituals,
right.
Shared direction that you're all
yeah.
going is
yeah,
all
love that.
Part of
yep.
carnival.
Yeah, and I will bet that it was soon after I read that chapter that I was up in Kingston and looking at the old Dutch church and winding the clock back and just imagining everyone having whatever hellish or wonderful week they had, farming and, you know, children getting sick or, you know, a horse that needed this or that or all these different things. And on Sunday, everybody gets on their horse and comes into town and gets into the church and just breathes a sigh of relief that their friends are there. They can share what happened. When he said that religion meant to bind intensely, just imagine that image of all these people coming into that church after the week they had and just being together.
Yeah. He used a phrase where he described it as the narrative truth and ritual coming together, right?
Yeah.
So it is your what happened to you that week between the last
right.
time you were in ritual.
Yeah.
And that's why so many churches these days and synagogues have a meal together after
right.
services, right?
Right?
It's a vestigial reflex to the way it used to be, right?
Right.
And
yeah,
it's often
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's often those people's favorite part of their liturgy is
yeah.
that community.
Right, exactly. He talks about it being a meeting place. What is it? Collective activity, tradition, shared presence. I mean, all these things that's what coming together should in community should be all about. And the church was that place to do it. And it's been so completely lost in the attempt to keep people coming, actually, which is very strange.
The chapter opened with the five truths, which
right.
I'm not going to run down other than to say that you could spend a week there alone.
Yes, exactly. Well, and I love focusing in on the idea of belief, because I've heard someone speak once and it really struck me that hope and belief have a crack in it for potentially not being true, right? Knowing is knowing. But believing or hoping or having faith, all that leaves a little crack open in the door. And it's just, it's something when somebody says, no, I believe that. And I say, do you know it? You know, because it's a there's quite a difference.
Big difference, as yeah. we now know.
Yeah.
The writing also addresses the idea of the literal story versus its function.
Yeah.
You know, the story, if you go to the Old Testament, you know, and people who literally think that animals two by two boarded this giant wooden ship.
Yep.
You know,
Earth is, what, 6,000 years old or something?
Yes.
I forget what the number is, but yeah.
If you're a literalist, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Versus the meaning of those stories and the parables that they were intended to tell, right? They were telling a story to people, and it was the best way they could do it was with storytelling.
Right.
So someone came up with a story that a large group of people would go, oh,
right.
And then underneath it was that meaning that went along with it.
Right.
And people have gotten so caught up in the literal, just so ridiculously caught up in across all the religions, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. And it probably came with the Enlightenment to some extent because, you know, the age of reason was a reaction to the power of the church, actually, and superstition and all this. But then everything becomes so incredibly literal, you can't find your way back, you know, to the abstract in the best sense of the word in terms of, you know, what the metaphor is. There was a guy in the South that talked, I think Caddo was the tribe, and when, I think it was De Soto, I think I've got these, when he came through, this guy said, you know, they called us sun worshipers, but what we worship was the power behind the sun, you know, and it's that kind of thing where it's like this literal, oh, they worship the sun. It's like, no, there's something greater than that we worship.
And what a shame that that they weren't able to identify at that time that this was ritual like we have ritual and that it has meaning beyond that. Oh, they worship that yellow thing in the sky.
Yeah, looking at that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how many Spanish came through the South? I mean, there are literal, you know, in what's now New Mexico or Arizona and coming in and saying in Spanish, you know, if you don't believe in God, we'll kill you. And of course, they couldn't understand what they said. And so, I mean, it was just this whole, the things that were done in the name of is extraordinary.
And here we are, you know, it's the third night of Hanukkah. We're in the Christmas season as well. We'll have Kwanzaa and, you know, Ramadan will be around soon and other cultural festivals as well. Indigenous festivals will be happening. And what is so amazing around those things is the culture, the cultural aspect of those things, the ritual around those things is what makes them so heartwarming, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. What you feel inside comes from some deeper place, which is, of course, what they're all about. And for instance, I mean, the Christ, the Son of God, comes at the time when the sun starts to turn back towards the earth. And you know, some of these things, and I think many things, you know, there's religious scholars that know this stuff, but how many religions lay over the top of these pagan rituals, these pagan sites, these things that are so deep in our natural core, you know, it's like hopping the train to get somewhere, taking advantage of the power that's underneath it. It's unbelievable.
Indeed, you know, and that's often the struggle that I have at this time of year is that culturally, I love the idea of coming together, of having meal, of thinking about the goodwill of all people.
Right.
And then, you know, then there is the, you know, the cry at Christmas time that there's a war on Christmas.
Right.
And there's this, and you can't say hey, Merry Christmas to people anymore, which is just simply not true.
No. And again, yeah, then that invasion of the commercial aspect of this, yeah, too, which is just, I mean, it's layers and layers and layers of using it for power, essentially, on top of what's actually this deep human need.
Yeah. The idea of religion in a localized community, you know, if you aren't exposed to outside forces and you've developed your ritual and your religion, if you take the particulars out, it's so similar across every example of it, right? There's a creation myth.
Right. Right.
There's a gathering.
Right.
There are these form and function that happen, and it, as we said, binds people together.
Right. Various trials and all these things. Yeah. That absolutely. And they are. It's just so frustrating.
Yeah, it's a great concept. The problem is that there are people involved in it, right? Human exactly. nature somehow gets involved in.
Yeah, which gets into, again, the power aspect of it and who's better and all this stuff that pulls you right out of what the whole point is. And so we need, so religion's loaded as a word, and yet it's necessary as a binding force.
It's Jimmy Buff. It's Peter Buffett. It's Radio Kingston, 1490 WKNY, Kingston, New York. The Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club. The book is Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. We just finished chapter 10. Next Tuesday, we'll move on to chapter 11, which is titled Utopia.
All right.
And speaking of the holiday season, if you go to ChelseaGreen.com, the publisher of the book, they have a 35% off holiday sale going on right now.
Well, there you go. God bless religion.
See you next Tuesday, Peter.